Nebraska State Senate Resources Committee. Today's date is Thursday, February 18th, 2010. We have quorum to conduct business. Senator Wagner, Senator Stevens, Senator Stedman, and myself, Wilkowski. I should also recognize we have Senator Dyson in the audience. And we, the purpose of today's meeting is to take up several proposed amendments. And the first amendment is that you have is an amendment by Senators Wilkowski and McGuire. And I will, everyone has a copy of that in front of them. And Fish, if you would walk us through that amendment and tell us what it does. Please go ahead.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. For the record, this is Mike Pawlowski, and I'm an aide to Senator McGuire. The amendment members should have is 26LS1197K.2. That establishes an energy efficiency revolving loan fund within the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. In members' packets, there was last week, I believe, a sponsor statement related to Senate Bill 223. The amendment before you reflects largely Senate Bill 223 with a few changes. And we have Brian Butcher from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation here to talk about the more detailed aspects of the program. What I would like to do is walk through the amendment, Mr. Chairman, and explain the changes that we have made in the amendment to the original underlying bill.
Yeah, thank you. And if you could at some point give us a general idea of what the bill actually does.
Mr. Chairman, it might be appropriate to bring Brian Butcher up to have him explain the general concept of the program.
I think that'd be helpful just so the committee members understand. Brian, if you wouldn't mind coming up and putting yourself on the record. And I should add, Senator Huggins is excused and Senator French is making a quorum in another committee, and I expect them here shortly. So please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Brian Butcher, Public Affairs Director for the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. To give you an idea of what this bill or this amendment would do, it takes $18 million of the $28 million that came from the state energy program stimulus, federal stimulus bill that the legislature overrode the veto on over the summer. 18 of the $28 million would be used to leverage up to $250 million in bonds to establish an AHFC, an energy efficiency revolving loan fund. And the revolving loan fund would, the eligible participants for the revolving loan fund would be pretty much all public facilities, state, municipal, schools. And how it would work is a facility, let's say you're the superintendent of a school district, you have a school that wants to participate, you would hire an energy performance contractor, and the contractor would come in, would go through, look at the energy efficiency needs of that school, would give you an estimate, let's just say $200,000 for what it would cost to bring that school up to energy efficiency, in a higher energy efficiency level, and would also guarantee you a certain savings. So if you put the $200,000 in, you will save 30% off what your energy costs will be. The savings you will receive after spending the $200,000 is then used to pay the loan back off. And the way it works, and this has been done in a lot of states, in fact, DOT has done it on a handful of buildings, of the state buildings in the state, is that if the contractor, if you do not get the costs, the energy efficient savings that have been promised in the contract, the contractor himself or herself will pay the what it was short. So you're guaranteed either through the savings of energy efficiency or through the contractor picking it up a certain amount of money that is then used to pay the loan fund back. When we first started talking about this program, and $18 million was set aside for energy efficiency for public facilities, there was kind of a panic out there because obviously $18 million is not going to go very far. By setting it up in this way, it then becomes not a case of who can take advantage of the program and who can't. It's more, can you take advantage of it this year or is it going to be another year? We'll be able to get to everybody. It's just a matter of time. So the U.S. Department of Energy was pleased at this approach, and approximately 3 weeks ago they signed off on the plan. So assuming passage of the legislation, we're ready to go.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, for the record, this is Mike Pawlowski again. There was some consternation that we heard when the original K version of the CS came out about the deletion of the Energy Efficiency Grant Fund from that version of the bill, from the original proposal. That being dependent on appropriations that are spent as one-time monies, this amendment was intended largely to replace that program and get to the same goal of upgrading our facilities, but doing it through the revolving loan fund Mr. Butcher described as opposed to a purely grant fund. That was the reason that was taken out of the original bill.
Senator Wagner.
How many years do you expect to go into the cycle to complete the buildings that need the work? Any estimate?
Through the chair, Senator Wagner, we don't have an estimate. We're now in the process, and I know there's parts of the bill that discuss trying to put together an index of state buildings in terms of which ones need work, which ones need the most work. And that's something that I suppose DOA and DOT and OMB possibly could, and the Department of Education could possibly put together an idea of what it might be on the state level. In terms of all municipal buildings, that would be much harder to put together. But we've been assured that the amount of work out there is probably going to exceed what it is we start with, which is why having a revolving loan fund that will continue to go is so beneficial.
Brian, if I could ask you, the money that we've already appropriated for weatherization and about $300 million and also for the energy rebate. Do you have any sense of how many jobs that's created in Alaska?
Mr. Chairman, I've heard an estimate of approximately 2,000 jobs. It's very hard to say. It's easier in the weatherization side of it because there are a couple hundred jobs that we know for sure have been because there are contractors and we pass it along to us. Trying to determine how many jobs have come from the home energy rebate side of it, where you've got a lot of work by a lot of contractors, maybe people that with the slowdown in the housing industry might have lost jobs that haven't. We've had a lot of anecdotal information from folks saying they've always had to lay folks off during the winter time, pick it back up in the summertime for construction, but the program has allowed them to keep the crew together and continuing to work on interior work for the home energy rebate program, and it's been beneficial to them. So we just have a rough estimate.
And with this bonding of about $250 million, do you have similar sort of projections about number of jobs that this would create?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, this would also be a great creator of jobs. How it works are there are four, based on DOT's testimony, they said there are four energy performance contractors in the state, but their expertise is just going in, doing the energy efficiency audit, and trying to figure out the numbers on how it works. Almost all of the work, actual work done to the buildings, is subcontracted to contractors in the local communities. So this would be a lot of work out there for probably small and mid-sized contractors, I would think.
Senator Wagner.
That was going to be my next question. You only have three or four energy performance contractors right now?
That's according to DOT testimony. So that's what it's been statewide.
That's spreading pretty thin. What's the likelihood of expanding that number over the immediate future?
Through the chair, Senator Wagner, I would expect that number to grow. I mean, certainly with the passage of this bill, if that does get established, there's a lot of work out there, and it'll be an exciting opportunity for a lot of Alaskans, I would think. The reason the number is so small is that there has been some energy performance contracting going on in the private sector and then a little bit with DOT, but it hasn't been used to a large enough degree at this point that we've had a lot of businesses going into it, but that should change.
I went through this process this last summer. So the guy that inspected my house on the initial inspection and then after I got through with the work is a engineer. So how would he become certified over and above what he does currently to work with this energy performance contractor, to be an energy performance contractor? Is there any process he would go through right now?
Through the chair, Senator Wagner, I don't know specifically what that would be. AHFC has been in charge of training the energy raters as well as the weatherization auditors for the weatherization program, so I would imagine Alaska Housing would have a role in that. We're currently with another part of the stimulus funds from the state energy program are updating the ACWARM software that energy raters use for residential homes to also be used for commercial buildings and public facilities. So we should, in short order, have the software necessary to do that training.
Yes, Fish.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, Senator Wagner, through the chair, I think an important thing to remember in looking at this section or this amendment is that it's the guarantee by the performance contractor of the savings, which then is financeable.
I understand all that.
Great.
I know the numbers are very low, and I just wanted to put it on record that we need to, if we're going to go into this program and we're going to bond $250 million, we better well be able to use it. And to use it, you got to have the people trained.
Yeah, if I could add to that, Mr. Chairman, Senator Wagner, we don't anticipate going out and doing a large $250 million bonding right up front. We're looking at doing it in stages as people are available to do the work, and something much like our weatherization program that would be ramped up as we had more businesses prepared to do it, as opposed to just having a big, you know, block of funds sitting unused because there aren't enough contractors in the state.
Great. Anything else, Mr. Butcher?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Mike, do you want to, anything else in the bill you want to walk us through real quickly? And
yes, Mr. Chairman, if I could just highlight a few points in the amendment itself. First is on page 1, lines 9 through 11. And this points to page 3, lines 18 in the legislation. This was a purpose section and on codified law, and the actual, since we're adding new sections that deal with energy efficiency, we had to add in references to those sections in the purpose section on page 3, line 18 of the K version. Then section 4 being added on page 1, lines 15. The changed language is on page 2 of the amendment, K2, and you'll see that on line 25 and 26. This is really empowering regional education attendance areas to apply for these loans. In the original language that we had seen, it wasn't clear that regional education attendance areas were included in the program, and since their powers are granted by statute, we had to actually modify the powers of a school board within an REAA to allow them to borrow. This was modeled on the teacher housing program authority that was granted through the AHSC program earlier. That's the fundamental change in the amendment before you, is the inclusion of REAAs so that they can participate in this program.
Thank you. And I should just mention, this bill was originally proposed by the governor, and it was in the Senate Energy Committee. We had a hearing on it last week or 2 weeks ago, and the governor's office said if you think that the energy bill will move 220, then you would have no problem putting it into ours. So thank you. I think this is a great idea. This is really an amazing chance for us to take a small amount of money and leverage it into something that really can make a difference all across Alaska. So thank you for this. Any questions on this proposed amendment? Okay, we'll set this amendment aside. And next up, we have another proposed amendment, and I'm going to call Jay Livey up at this point. And this is, and I'll read it. If you look in the upper right-hand corner, this is an amendment. In the upper right-hand corner, it's 26-LS1197/K.1. And and Jay, if you could please just tell us what this amendment in general would do. We're not going to adopt it today. We don't have a quorum. But if you could go ahead and tell us what this does, and then after doing that, just walk us through the sections.
Okay, thank you, Senator. My name is, for the record, my name is Jay Livey from Senator Hoffman's office. As most of you may have gotten word from constituents last year, we were involved in in lots of conversations about energy prices and about the ability that families in Alaska had regarding their ability to pay their heating bills, particularly last year when oil was peaking at $140 per barrel. So was the price of fuel oil all over Alaska, particularly in western Alaska.
Jay, if I can just interrupt you for 1 second and welcome Senator French to the committee. He just came to us from another committee, CRNA, where hopefully they just moved the bill that I had before the committee. Please go ahead, Jay.
Thank you, Senator. As a result of that, we began to look at Alaska's two heating assistance programs. And we wanted to take a look at those in the context of how responsive are they to the actual price of fuel? And are they responsive at all to when fuel prices change for individuals? And so that, Mr. Chairman, has led us here today with these amendments. Now, I've prepared for you an outline that should be in your packet. It's about 8 pages that looks like this. And I think that it would avoid confusion a bit if I could just run through that document.
Hold on 1 second, Jay. Make sure everyone has a copy of that.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's called Alaska's Current Heating Assistance Programs.
So it should be in the back of the amendment. Let's see.
Is this amendment been moved, or where are we?
We didn't have a quorum, so we were just discussing the amendment. I think we're going to leave it at that for today. But please go ahead.
Thanks, Senator. So what I've done here is I've provided some information that is just on leading up to the amendments, and then showing a little bit about what the impact would be should these amendments be adopted. And first of all, I want to state that this amendment is a little bit of a departure from the rest of the legislation, and I do really appreciate your consideration of this amendment. These heating programs deal with individual assistance. A lot of the rest of the bill, of course, is dealing with institutional changes to energy programs. But these two programs deal specifically with individual assistance. And on the first page, we see that Alaska has two heating assistance programs. The first one is called Low Income Heating and Energy Assistance Program, better known as LIHEAP. It's been around for a long, long time. It's a federal program. And you see there that it serves anybody, individuals at 150% or less of poverty. And the eligibility limit is about $41,000 per year for a family of four. And the current federal appropriation, even though your sheet says $23 million, the department has told me a better figure is $27 million. So the 23 there should be 27. And I apologize for that.
Just so I'm clear, and I probably should know this, but I'll just ask.
Mm-hmm.
Is there no state contribution to LIHEAP, or is it purely a federal program?
It's purely a federal, Senator.
Thank you.
The next program, however, it's a good question. The next program, Alaska Heating Assistance Program, was initiated 2 years ago. That is a state-only program, and that provides assistance to individuals between 150 and 220% of poverty. Eligibility limit, 63,000, family of four. Current appropriation is $5 million. So those are the two state assistance heating programs that these amendments are focused on. Now, as we went through this process, we had several objectives in mind. I've listed two there. First, to make Alaska's heating assistance programs more responsive to a family's actual heating costs by increasing the amount of the assistance. And I'll run through those numbers for you in a minute. Secondly, we wanted to make changes to how the program is administered in such a way that we do a better job of recognizing actual heating costs. And I will run through an example of that one also. As we proceeded, we had several things in mind, several principles in mind that we did not want to violate. The first was we wanted a statewide approach. The issue last year about rising fuel costs as a result of crude oil prices going above 140, that was a statewide issue. I don't think there was a community in Alaska where fuel prices didn't go up. And so we wanted a statewide approach. And in fact, I have put in your packet a document that lists all of the communities in Alaska that receive money through Alaska heating assistance programs. And you'll see that list has virtually every community in Alaska. And in fact, the largest users in Alaska is along the rail belt, which would be understandable. That's where most of the people live. So in terms of not in terms of percentage of people using, but in terms of absolute numbers of recipients, the rail belt communities are the largest users. Second principle, Mr. Chairman, is we wanted to use the existing administrative structure as much as we could. LIHEAP has a structure that uses a point system, and I'm going to explain that later, so just bear with me for a second. But they use a point system that assigns points to families based on income, fuel, where they live, how cold it is where they live, how big the house is, a variety of things, variety of items that actually make the program, we believe, fairly responsive to an individual's situation. So in that sense, it is a needs-based program. Also, the current program, their administrative structure is very efficient. They have they operate with some part-time help. They have a few full-time employees, but generally, for the amount of assistance and help that goes out, it's a very efficient program, and we did not want to screw with that. Essentially, we wanted to keep them that way. The third principle, Mr. Chairman, is we wanted to make the program responsive to fuel costs. Again, last year we found out that was a serious problem with many, many consumers. People could not pay their fuel bills, had to make serious choices about what they wanted to pay. I'll give you examples of that also. Fourth principle, Mr. Chairman, we wanted to establish an incentive for weatherization. It's become before this committee many times, and you hear it around this building that actually one of the better energy programs is conservation. If you can keep people from using energy, then that's a good thing to do. And so we tried to work that into this proposal. So on page 3 of the handout, Mr. Chairman, what I've done is provided just a few points there about how the program actually operates. I just want to run through these in a hurry just to give you an idea. Each year, an individual must apply to the program. A household must apply. The applications that come in contain the information that the department uses to assign points for each applicant. And let me explain the points issue in just a minute. Third item, and of course, I've written these down very simply. They're a little more complicated in actuality, but generally the department estimates the cumulative number of points that they'll receive in a given year. And they do that based on how many they had last year and changes and that sort of thing. The department divides the available appropriation by the total number of points to get a dollar value. So we know there's $27 million federal dollars. So the individuals that are under 150% of poverty that can use that number, we have an estimate of their number of points. We do simple mathematics, and we come up with this year we're paying $113 per point. It's a mathematical calculation. The assistance that an individual gets is not paid to them directly. On their application, they have to designate a vendor who's their oil distributor, their fuel distributor, and they the department simply sets up a credit account in that person's name with the vendor. And as they use fuel, that account is depleted. Now, we've talked several times about points, and I've sort of avoided that discussion up until now. Remember, the information for determining points is based on the individual's application as well as some other information. So within the application, points that a family has depend on some variables. One of those is household income. Secondly is heating degree days, and that is information the department gets from other places. It's a standard heating degree day chart, and I've also included a sample of that in your packet. And for each community in Alaska, depending on, for each community in Alaska, there's a heating degree day assigned. And the number of points that the family gets depends on the heating degree days as well as the type and the cost of fuel that they are using. The number of points also can depend on the type of house in which the applicant lives, the size of the house, and if the family has children, elderly, or individuals experiencing a disability. So taken together, the number of points that a household gets is a pretty good representation, I believe, of what their heating situation is. Is the climate cold? What kind of a house it is? How much does their fuel cost? Who's living in the house? How big of a house it is? So, Mr. Chairman, if we turn to page 4, what I've done there is I have prepared two sample calculations that run us through how this might work. So if the first example is a household in Tuxuk Bay, if you look at the heating degree days chart and the fuel they use, they get 21 points. Because they live in a two-bedroom house, there's no adjustment. Had they lived in a larger house, they would have gotten more points. Had they lived in a mobile home, there would be an adjustment had they lived other places. But in this case, they live in a two-bedroom house, so there's no adjustment. This family has a poverty level of between 75% and 100% of the poverty level. So they get a 4.2-point deduction for that, 80% of their 21 points. Had they been under 50% of poverty, there would be no deduction. But at 50% of poverty is when deduction starts. The household contains children, so they get 1 point. As a result, their total points are 18. I did the same basic calculation for Fairbanks. Changed the poverty level a bit just to show you how it might work. This family slightly has more income, Consequently, 50% of the point total is taken away as opposed to 80% in the first example. Work through the numbers. They have 6 points. That family has 6 points. Under current program, we pay $115 per point. So we do the math, and the household from Tuxuk Bay would get $2,070. The Fairbanks family would get $690. This money is available to the family during the winter heating season. And again, it goes as it's a vendor account set up in their name with their fuel supplier.
And Jay, this is the way the current system works.
Correct.
And how, you said this is available during the winter heating season. What months is this typically available?
Through the chair, Mr. Chairman, I think that we have folks in the department here that can help me out with this if I don't get it right, but applications begin in November and they have to be completed by, I believe, April 15th. But the money goes on their books and can be used anytime during the year.
Senator French.
Thanks, and maybe you explain, but just tell me again, what mechanism exists to keep the point total and the appropriation per family from exceeding what you have to distribute statewide? You see what I mean?
Through the chair, Senator, the department just does simple mathematics where you divide the available appropriation by the estimated number of points.
So that the multiplication doesn't exceed the total appropriation.
That's correct.
Got it. Okay, thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman, again, on the bottom of this page, then, we've done the simple math, and we see that the assistance is $2,070 for Tuxuk, $690 for Fairbanks. If we go on to page 5, then, I've done a current heating cost estimate. And what I've assumed is that during the winter, and these frankly are very conservative numbers, I've assumed that a family would use 600 gallons of fuel And that, I assume that by 100 gallons for 6 months. And again, that's pretty conservative because it's pretty cold out in some places in Alaska in October and April. But Tuxuk Bay, $6.08 per gallon. Their fuel, that household's fuel bill for those 600 gallons would be $3,648. In Fairbanks, $3.07 per gallon. 600 gallons would mean that their fuel bill would be $1,842. Then I did the math and just divided, saw what percentage of that total amount was our assistance. And in Tuxuk Bay, we're paying 58% of that household's need. In Fairbanks, 37% of that household need. So that's, Mr. Chairman, that real briefly is the way the program currently works.
Senator French.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. And could you just one more time go back and show me how the relative poverty of the individual influences the number of points they get?
Through Chair, Senator French, and I have folks in the department here that, again, if I get into too much trouble, they can straighten me out. But within the department regulations, they describe how they will affect how the points are affected by a household's poverty. So if a household is 50% of the poverty level, if their income is 50% of the poverty level or less, then they get 100% of the points. If in this
there's no deduction.
No deduction. If for example, they fall between 500, I think it's been 50% and 100% of poverty as this person Tuxuk did, then they get 80%.
Okay.
And the progression continues. So if you're for example, the Fairbanks example, the family was between 126 and 150% of poverty, they get half of the total.
And the more points you lose, the less money you're going to get in the end.
Correct, because this is taking a percentage of the total points.
Thank you.
Please proceed, Jay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now I'd like to turn to page 6, if I could. And this gets into the amendment itself. What I want to do here is I've listed the sections here in order. I think it might be easier to explain them, so I might jump around a bit when I come to it, but I'll try to explain that. Section 21 changes the name of the Alaska Heating Assistance Program to the Alaska Affordable Heating Program. Again, we thought that name change did a better job of trying to explain our vision of the program, which is that we should try to make heating more affordable for residents of the state, and have it not just be assistance. Section 22, Mr. Chairman, establishes the Alaska Affordable Heating Fund in the Department of Revenue. This section simply sets up a fund that is used to contain funds that can be used for this program. We have no there is no provision in this bill to put money into that fund at this point. It's just establishing it. Section 23 conforms existing law to the name change. Now sections 24 and 25 contain more significant changes to the program. And this is where I'm going to try to skip around a bit I don't want to confuse everybody. One of the things we wanted to do, remember, was that we wanted to make this program, these programs, we wanted to make them linked more closely to the price of oil. So one of the things we did in section 24, we said that if the price of a barrel of crude oil, as measured by the Department of Revenue, if the price of a barrel of crude oil exceeds $150 a barrel, then what we want to do is we want to extend eligibility for the highest income group from 225% of poverty to 250% of poverty. And so we see there that 225%, we see the $62,000 figure for family of four. If oil exceeds 150 per barrel, we would raise that percentage to 250% of poverty at $68,000.
Senator French.
Thank you. I guess I've just lost you somewhere. Where exactly on the, are you on the amendment or are you on the?
The amendment.
The amendment, okay. Yeah. This is /K.1.
Yeah, it should be section 24.
24. I wasn't seeing any oil prices, so I was just
It's written so that there are several changes going on. Through the chair, Senator, it's written so that there are several changes going on here at once. But
I see it refers to section 25.
That's correct, and so I'm hopefully it'll all make sense here in a minute.
Okay.
And actually, it's going to have to happen in a minute.
Okay.
Happened yet.
And there is an explanation in the handout that Jay's prepared as well.
Okay, so now that's a good question, Senator. Let's then go to page 7, and we'll go to paragraph number 2.
7 in the explanation.
7 in my handout, page 7, number 2. This is the other link where we're trying to correspond the price of oil to our level of affordability. And what we've said there is that we're raising the dollars per point based on how much a barrel of crude oil costs. Remember, we said before that the points were simply calculated as a division of the available appropriation divided by the number of points. Well, here we're actually saying what the dollar value of a point should be depending on what the barrel of oil is. So, for example, we say if oil is less than $75 per barrel, then the dollars per point is $130. If crude oil is between $75 and $100, then the price of a point goes to $140. Then we go to $150, $165 as we exceed $150 per barrel. Again, the idea there is to have some link between the amount of assistance we're giving an individual family and the price of a barrel of oil. We're trying to make some connection there. Third thing we've done, if we go down to the next paragraph, number 3, because what we've said is that $130 per point when crude oil is less than $75, what that means is we've automatically raised the floor per point amount for this program to $130. It's currently $115. We've raised it to $130 because oil will always be less than $75 a barrel. So again, that's the third thing we've done here. We've linked it to the price of oil, plus we've upped the starting point from $115 to $130. Next, Mr. Chairman. We have also added 1 point to families, an incentive to families who apply for the weatherization program. Now, at this point, I have to say that this section, I've had some talks with the department about this, and this section may be problematic for them because of the administration involved in getting this information. We have a variety of weatherization providers out there, and collecting the information about applications and other things might be problematic, but they can speak to that. The last paragraph, number 5 on this page, Mr. Chairman, because we did not want this to become a entitlement program, we have given the department the ability to prorate the assistance amounts if sufficient money has not been appropriated to the legislature to meet these dollar per points that we've put in statute. So, Mr. Chairman, putting this...
Senator Wagner. One more time, please.
Well, through the chair. Senator, we've... because in paragraph number 2, we have put in statute the amount, the dollars per point, depending on the price of a barrel of crude, then we've also said in paragraph number 5 that if that amount of money is not sufficient to the program, in other words, if the legislature has other needs, legitimate needs for that money, and doesn't appropriate the money needed to do that, to pay for that, then we've said that the department can prorate those amounts. So in that sense, Mr. Chairman, it's not an entitlement program.
Senator Wagner.
But once we initiate this program, it becomes an entitlement program. That's kind of like the longevity bonus. It's pretty hard to get away from it once you put it out there.
Through the chair, that would be a it's set up to be a way of providing an indication, certainly, of how much money should be appropriated based on the level of affordability. But legally that's not, legally it doesn't have to be appropriated that way.
Senator Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I the comparisons between this and the longevity bonus is good, but it's also misleading. And the difference, and it's worth, you know, thinking about, is that the longevity bonus we paid, you know, whether we had a deficit or whether we had a surplus. The design of this, which is close to the PASCVAM plan we talked about, which is basically providing some assistance for fuel oil prices when oil prices get high, is that the money's here and the money's available only when oil prices are very high. And when oil prices are very low, the need for assistance is far lower because your home heating costs are far lower. And at the same time, the state treasury doesn't have any money in it extra. So it's there's a nice sort of congruence, if you will, between the need and the amount of money available to pay for it here in the Capitol. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Livey? Jay, thank you. Can I get some members of the department to come up and you could put yourself on the record.
Senator Wilkowski, for the record, my name is Ron Creer. I'm Chief of Field Operations for the Division of Public Assistance, and through one of my regional managers, I oversee the heating assistance programs for the state.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Department have any comments on this proposed amendment?
Well, yes, I do, as a matter of fact. I think, in a nutshell, essentially, this is the Alaska Heating Assistance Program with some variations, and Jay actually pointed those things out. First, of course, it does fix the funding levels to the average price of a barrel of North Slope crude, but then it also fixes the dollar value for community heating points, and also it potentially pushes eligibility up to 250% of the federal poverty guidelines. Some of the provisions cause us some administrative challenges to. And for example, the original methodology, and it's in section 25, page 3, I believe, lines 13 through 17, where it talks about calculating the average price of a barrel of North Slope crude for the prior fiscal year. So it makes forward funding planning a little bit more of a challenge because we're looking back at a prior year. So for example, if this bill amendment was enacted effective July 1st, we would be looking back at the prior fiscal year for the average price of a barrel of North Slope crude between February and September. So it would be starting the fiscal year, and we wouldn't have the window that we'd need to calculate the funding level, because it would be July, and we'd be looking at the average price between February and September of the prior fiscal year. That creates some challenges for us, of course, but it's also a concern that you could have a low value of oil in that prior fiscal year, but a very high cost of oil in the program year and come up short. So that's a little bit of a concern, the uncertainty of that. We're always uncertain about our federal funding levels. Through the LIHEAP program, the feds are actually looking at, and President Obama's proposed budget for next year, kind of a similar model for triggering payments for LIHEAP. We never really know from year to year, although we always anticipate getting the same as our block grant. So that creates some challenges for us because it's uncertain what would happen if we got sufficient federal funding to pay LIHEAP in excess of $130 a point. Whether the statute would prohibit us from doing that or not, it isn't quite clear at this point. One other area is the estimation of the service population in section 24, page 2, lines 21 through 22, where they bump it up when the price of a barrel of oil gets up over $150 a barrel and we can increase the income eligibility limits. It's difficult for us to estimate the population that would, the size of the population we'd be serving. Also, it's difficult for us to resource, because if it's a significant increase, we would probably have to find additional staff resources. So when we have to cost this out, we need to look at the possibility of perhaps long-term non-perm positions that we could bring in as the demand came up. I think overall, some of the provisions are going to be very challenging for our tribal grantees. We've got 11 tribal organizations across the state that operate tribal LIHEAP programs and 8 that operate ACAP regional programs. And administrative demands on those organizations are very, very challenging. And additional administrative burden in this process may make it very problematic for some of those organizations to continue to do the programs. They all have different plans. They're approved by the federal government, their federal plan, and currently our regional programs mirror their federal plan. So we have many tribal organizations that don't use a point system to issue benefits. So this would, they have different methodologies. So it may be, may create a challenge for those folks to continue to run regional house heating assistance programs, which may mean that work would come back to the division as well. The weatherization incentive, as Jay mentioned, can create some problems as well. And he kind of highlighted the majority of them. Many providers out there, many different sources for heating, for weatherization assistance. How we would track that, how we would get that information would be something of a challenge and would probably be a good question for somebody from AHFC if it's even practical to do it. There's also many people that are ineligible. I think you only get one every 15 years. It's, if you change dwellings, you may apply for another one. Renters have to get the cooperation of their landlord to pursue them. So there's a lot of factors that make it a bit of a challenge for us to incentivize participants for, in the program, at least on the surface. That would be a challenge, could be a challenge for us. The section 25, page 3 and 4, where we're talking about the proration, that we'd need a little more clarification on that as well. There's some language in there about in the first year that finances are provided, you may have to, it's uncertain what would happen after the first year. And to some extent, the proration language kind, it's, in my mind anyway, it kind of conflicts with setting statutory points and then having a way of overriding that. And honestly, in my perfect world, I would like to see a set funding for the heating assistance programs. And having that funding levels tied to the price of oil makes a lot of sense. And I think, as Jay said, it recognizes the additional demand on people that are receiving the assistance. And it gives us kind of a fixed basis to operate the program on. Overall, the general administration would be the same. The only place where we could conceivably have some additional administrative demands would be trying to address the possibility of having some caseload growth when we pushed into the 225% limit.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you for your testimony. We have a few people online, Joel St. Aubin, Robin Wilson, Sarah Fisher-Goat. Any testimony you wish to give? I'll take that as a no. And Jay, we're going to set this aside, but I think this is a really an excellent attempt to try to solve a problem, really looking at sort of the key issues that are out there, the issues of extremely high costs in rural Alaska and other parts of Alaska, taking into account people's relative abilities to pay, and taking into account the price of oil. When we have oil at $75 a barrel and higher, we're making a lot of money, but that makes life much harder for Alaskans in fuel costs. So I think this really is something worth looking more into, and we'll be taking this up in the future. Okay, we have one last amendment for the day, and that is by Senator Dyson. And Senator Dyson, if you could step forward, please. Thank you for bearing with us.
And thank you for hearing it. what this amendment does is inserts into SB 220 a section that has the Department of Transportation evaluating using compressed natural gas for the transportation sector in our state. All of the things we're trying to do with more efficient and cleaner fuels, very few of them applied well in the transportation sector. That means vehicles. And in fact, but compressed natural gas or propane does. There, according to the Department of Energy, in 2006 figures, the last ones I have, there are somewhere over 8 million vehicles in the world that are powered by compressed natural gas. Probably several of you have seen folks rolling around with a propane tank in the back of their pickup. Those are dual fuel vehicles. They can run them on gasoline or propane when they get it. A number of folks where Senator French and Senator Wilkowski and I live have generators sitting at home that are run by natural gas, power goes off. And a number of our neighbors have what's called a slow fill compressor in their house, and they can pump natural gas into their vehicle overnight while it's parked. Making this compressed natural gas work is kind of a chicken and an egg sort of thing. The fast fill compressors are a bit expensive, and until there's a network of them, folks are quite unlikely to, or much less likely to convert to natural gas. In Portland, Oregon, they have all their school buses are run on compressed natural gas, 12,000 students a day. Utah has most of their fleet vehicles now are run on compressed natural gas, and the emissions from them, EPA type monitored emissions, are at least 20% less than being run from gasoline. What we're doing here is asking the Department of Transportation to evaluate it. What I anticipate will happen is they will say, yeah, everybody in the world virtually is moving in this direction, not everybody, but many. And if the public sector will get some fast fill compressors set up, the private sector will very quickly follow. And there are lots of folks, and I think there's some stuff in your package here that are very glad to provide the technology. Our research, we've talked to two different national manufacturers, school buses. If you order the buses set up from the get-go to run on compressed natural gas, very close to a push on the original price. One of them said yes, the other one said maybe 10,000 more per copy. If you drive from your jurisdiction to mine, you'll go by the municipal landfill. They are producing approximately the equivalent of 5,000 gallons of gasoline per day of methane from there, enough to run all the fleet vehicles, private and government, in the entire city is waste from the methane from there. So we went on several accounts, cleaner fuel, cheaper fuel. I've talked to folks who are going 9,000 miles between oil changes and the oil is perfectly clean. There are light commercial vehicles, i.e. pickups around with 1 million miles on them that are run on compressed natural gas. And so what we're doing here getting started on that which much of the world is already doing. Many of us, I think, have been disappointed that both hydrogen as a fuel and battery technology has not been has technological problems that have kept that from being the huge solution that we were looking for. Here's one that's been around for 35 years, well proven, and all we're doing here is getting us going.
Great. Thank you, Senator Dyson. I appreciate you bringing this forward. I read your Compass piece on this a few weeks ago in the paper. Very intriguing idea. I think it's definitely worth something that is worth pursuing. Questions by the committee? Senator French.
Thanks. How many, are there any operating compressed natural gas stations now in Alaska? Not private ones, but, you know, commercial ones?
Railroad's got one.
Okay.
And they're doing a bit with it, and kind of as a pilot project.
I've been in other cities where I see buses running on compressed natural gas. I mean, apparently it's not that complicated. It's just what's holding us up, do you think?
Yep. It's a chicken and an egg.
Right. You got to get started to get
started.
You
got to get going.
Right.
And
get going. Right.
We will be answering the question, why haven't you guys done this?
Right, if we don't.
If we don't, and it's just well past time to get going.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you. And do we have anyone from the administration, Department of Transportation or otherwise, who would like to make any comments on this? Welcome to the committee. Please put yourself on the record.
For the record, my name is Mary Sorokin. I'm Special Assistant to the Commissioner of the Department of Transportation Public Facilities. Senator Dyson introduced this bill last year, and we have looked at it and analyzed it, and we have a very small fiscal note associated with the task, and if passed, we'll go forward and study.
Okay. Any questions? Okay, great. We're not adopting any amendments today. Yes, Senator Wagner.
I've got one I'll pass around.
Sure.
If you don't mind.
Let's
just the three of us, so the rest of them are going to lose out.
Well, you know, this a little bit different way, I think, of doing the amendments, but I think with this bill and the issues that are before us, it's very complex, and so I think it's a good idea to get these out and discuss them and then see if we have comments from the administration or other groups. Thank you, Senator Dyson. Did you have one last thing?
Senator Wagner, is this on a different subject?
Yeah, we're all done.
All right.
Yes.
And there's bills pending in Congress that will give very significant tax incentives or rebates for folks who are buying CNG vehicles.
Fantastic. Thank you, Senator Dyson. We will bring this up in the future.
Give me a warning.
Yeah, we will.
Please.
Absolutely. Thank you, Senator Wagner.
I didn't plan to do this till next week, but we've got a lot of time. It's a pretty simple amendment. Basically, I'm trying to set it up to where we take fluorescent bulbs throughout the state. They're a tremendous saver of electrical energy. They give you the same light, and distribute them at the state expense for 3 years until people get used to seeing how much reduction they get in their power bills. And after that time, they should be pretty well convinced to go ahead and provide those bulbs themselves. The one problem I've got right now, and I'm going to try and investigate this between now and next week, these things are high in mercury. Mm-hmm. So we need to know what kind of a collection program they have in the rural areas. I mean, they've already got fluorescent bulbs out there, so there's got to be a process they collect these bulbs in the rural area, but I don't know what it is yet. So that's one thing I want to look at before we get real serious with it. But I think it would save a tremendous amount of power overall, a lot of money.
Thank you. Questions for Senator Wagner? Yes, Senator French.
Quickly, and who does the cost fall on?
State of Alaska.
Okay.
Yeah.
We provide the money to
get
it
started. We would subsidize it for 3 years, and hopefully after that time we'd change habits.
Thank you.
And I'll just ask, we've got Sarah Fisher Goad from the AEA online. Sarah, are you still there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am.
I know you don't have the amendment in front of you, but you've seen the amendment. Does the administration have any comments on this, or do you have any comments on behalf of the Energy Authority?
record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Sarah Fisher Goh, Deputy Director of Operations for the Alaska Energy Authority. I think if I'm the amendment that I understood is being revised, so I think I've seen an amendment, but I don't know if I've seen the latest version.
Okay.
Yes, sir. It's pretty much the same as you looked at in my office.
Through the chair, Senator Wagner, as we discussed, I think the one thing that we would need to do is evaluate it. I have a couple people internal to AEA looking at it to see if we can get some estimated costs on what that would cost for AEA to implement a light bulb exchange program.
Right.
Yeah, and we're not adopting this today, but if you could do that, Sarah, that'd be real helpful for us in the next few days. I think we'll probably look at maybe taking these amendments up next week or the following week. So that would be very helpful if you could get us more detailed comments and, of course, any fiscal implications. Yes, Senator Wagner.
Yes, sir. One question. I think you heard me raise it. We briefly, I think, talked about this in my office, but is there a collection system already in place in rural Alaska to collect the bulbs, fluorescents?
Through the chair, Senator Wagner, I would need to look into that. I think internal, at least in Anchorage, my understanding, I think there are utilities, I believe, Chugach, my understanding, will take light bulbs. However, there's also a private company, Total Reclaim, that will take light bulbs. I don't know if there's any coordinated effort in rural Alaska communities to turn in the light bulbs.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, Sarah, thank you. And other questions? No, seeing none. I guess I would ask the administration on this amendment and on the proposed LIHEAP. That's not actually LIHEAP, but the proposed amendment by Senator Hoffman's office. If we could get fiscal notes by next Monday afternoon, that would be very helpful for us in moving along. And with that, it's 4:35, and no more business, no other amendments before the committee. We are adjourned.